From the WBOI studios in Fort Wayne, Indiana, this is the WBOI Politics Podcast, a show that explores the critical issues that Hoosiers are facing after the 2020 election, and stories that the WBOI and Indiana Public Broadcasting news teams are covering this season. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host at 89.1 WBOI, and I will be your host. We're a long way from Inauguration Day. But we have passed Election Day, or perhaps more accurately for 2020, Election Week. During this episode, we're going to hear analysis from Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue Fort Wayne. This podcast exists because of his thoughtful expertise on all things politics. We'll hear him speaking with WBOI News Director Rebecca Green. Enjoy.
I am here with Andy Downs. We're talking via Zoom today for the WBOI Politics Podcast. Thank you, Andy, for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy, let's start with just a general overview of how the 2020 general election went in the state of Indiana. We have heard that in some places turnout was high, in some places turnout was really high, in some places turnout was pretty normal. It's been kind of a mixed bag. I think it depended on the politics of a particular county and the politics of particular races in those counties. What can you tell us about the state election now that we're a couple weeks out from it?
You're right. We saw a turnout that was really high, and sort of high, which is better than what a lot of people might expect for how our turnout has been going, which would sort of be okay, less than okay, and even less than that. We don't exactly have a great track record for turnout. So congratulations to people in the state for showing up to vote. That's wonderful. We also know that the election was run pretty smoothly. We didn't hear a whole lot of complaints from around the state. I spoke with people in just about every corner of the state and in the middle of the state about how the administration of the election went. Nobody had massive complaints about what went on. So that's a good thing. And I think that might be in part because we put so much emphasis on early voting, whether that was because of stories done by folks like you, or because campaigns were pushing folks out, or because of other sources saying, hey, go vote early, go vote early. I think that did get an awful lot of people through the system. Folks who had problems, we were able to work out those problems. The machinery was up and running. People knew how to work it. So all of those things, I think, actually contributed to a very well-run election. And I would say a very well-run election at a time when there were several factors that could have made it go in the exact opposite direction.
What are some of those factors?
Anytime you have to change locations, anytime you have to change physical voting locations, as well as where the administration of the election is going to go on, change how you're going to be tabulating the votes, as in seeing a big increase in one kind of voting versus another, all of those things sort of deviate from the norm. And while every election administrator is prepared for some of that, when you put all of it out there at the same time, you really sort of create not necessarily a perfect storm, but a situation that could go poorly. Obviously, around the state and certainly up here, we know it did not. We know that the election administrators, and that means the people on the boards, as well as the hired staff who are temporary, those who are permanent, everybody ended up doing a really, really nice job around here. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find folks with complaints that go beyond sort of the accidental things that just kind of happen from time to time, little mistakes here and there, but for the most part, quite well run.
Has Indiana ever had an election that didn't go as smoothly?
If you look throughout the state, though, I know a lot of people criticize Indiana and they're maybe not happy with the laws we have here, for example, the voter ID law or the way we do districting, all these sorts of things. But we in Indiana have actually been pretty good at administering elections for a long time. That doesn't mean that we haven't had problems. That doesn't mean there aren't ways we could improve things. But we actually have been pretty good about this. There have been instances, obviously 2008, with those incredibly long lines, but we've learned from that and the lines have been shortened. If you go down to Marion County's had some issues in the past. Up in the region, they've had some issues in the past. Every now and then you can find an example of a judge who said, no, you have to keep the polls open a little bit longer. So we find those sorts of things, but they're usually isolated to a particular place and they're not about administration throughout the entire state. Also, when you look at instances of fraud, we actually have had some of those prosecuted over the years. They quite often center on voter registration or signatures on petitions, an instance in the north central part of the state about signatures on petition. and they are small in number. There was an individual in the Delaware County area, the Muncie area, who attempted to engage in some fraudulent behavior that was a very small number of ballots given the total number of ballots cast. So we do a pretty good job of catching the folks who are doing it. And even if they are or had been successful, it's usually not enough to throw an entire election. I think that's a testament to the election workers, but also the way we view the elections. We understand the importance of these things, and we sort of police ourselves from one person to another.
So let's talk a little bit more specifically now about the state political parties. The Indiana GOP had a pretty good night. The Indiana Dems did not have a great night on the 3rd. Since Election Day, there has been some shakeup in the state Democratic Party, probably because of some things that happened on the 3rd. So let's talk a little bit about the parties and where they go from here.
Well, the Republican Party had to be awfully happy with what happened. I mean, they won every statewide office. They picked up seats in the House of Representatives. Really, the only blemish in some respects is losing one seat in the Senate, in the state Senate. That's a pretty darn good day. And when you look at the margins by which Republicans won, they can legitimately say this is a Republican state and have all kinds of evidence to back that up. So obviously, they're going to want to continue what they're doing. They're going to want to try to continue to bring in resources and new members and make sure that the way elections are run or not saying they're trying to defraud the system, but they're going to make sure that things run in a way that is similar to what got them to this position. They're not necessarily going to be looking for changes. Having said that, there is at least one Republican who was running for office and said he wanted to expand mail-in ballot to be no-fault mail-in ballot. I will point out he lost. So, you know, whether you find other Republicans interested in doing that, we'll have to wait and see. The Democratic Party really has to consider this as not at all a good day. Losing the statewide offices, Weinsapel's loss to Rokita in the attorney general race was a much wider margin than people expected it to be. The fact that they lost seats in the House in spite of hundreds of thousands of dollars being spent on some races, that money that was spent on those races narrowed some gaps, but not nearly enough to make it look like those races might be competitive with some additional effort. The one thing they can point to is picking up a Senate seat. Now, that has resulted in a few things. The chair of the state party has said he's not going to run for re-election, probably would have had some difficulty getting re-elected if he had run for re-election next year. And we saw in the state Senate almost an entire wholesale change in leadership. And remember, this is a group of 11 people. So when you think about the three or four positions that you want to call leadership positions, that's pretty much a wholesale change of about everything. So we can look for maybe some new direction out of the state Senate Democratic caucus. But when you have 11 out of 50 members, you're still very much in the super minority. I heard an interview with the new minority leader, Greg Taylor, and he was talking about the fact that in the sort of minority they're in, there is only one option, and that's to try and figure out how to work with the other side. He talked about the fact that they really can't have pride of authorship because in the minority, your bills may not even get heard. So you have to be willing to not only work with the other side, but let them take credit for the good things that are going on. And it just points to a very difficult challenge for Democrats, not only statewide in terms of those offices, but in the state house itself.
People want policies, but they vote party. And there's becoming more and more so this idea that people are the party that they identify with. Indiana has decided pretty firmly that they are a Republican state made up of Republicans. And that seems to be indicative of politics on a larger scale in America generally, that people, they identify, I am a Republican, I am a Democrat, and changing those things or voting outside of those lines is almost like changing your religion. I would like to hear your thoughts on that as somebody who studies politics from a sociological perspective as well, what you think about that and what this might mean.
Political parties are often a shorthand. We as voters don't want to spend a lot of time doing deep, deep research. And I know that sounds cynical and awful, but think about the best informed voter you know. even that person may not know what they want to do on a judge race or on a township board race or something else. And that's the best informed person you know. Take a step back to that person who shows up only during presidential elections and maybe doesn't even do that consistently. You really then are looking at voters who are going to maybe only vote in one or two races because it's those are the races they see the most about or hear the most about, or they're going to use the party label as a proxy. There is nothing wrong with that because the parties theoretically are supposed to stand for something. You know, a Republican is supposed to be a Republican. A Democrat is supposed to be a Democrat. What's interesting right now is that although both parties have always had multiple voices in them, we are seeing those voices driving the parties to some degree further out to the edge. You know, if you listen to the Republican Party, you can hear folks who are pushing further and further out to the right, which makes those moderate Republicans, what some people might think of as a Republican or certainly sort of like an Eisenhower Republican, feel a bit isolated. And then you have on the Democratic side, you have folks who are pushing further and further out to the left, making it more difficult for moderates there. What's happening then is then a fight over the position of the party. Is the party a left party or a moderate party? Is it a moderate party or a right party? That fight is then making it a little more difficult for voters to use the party label as a proxy because they hear conflicting stories. Adding on to that even further is that you do get regional differences. Let's face it, a Democrat or a Republican in Indiana is probably different than a Democrat or a Republican in California or in Alabama. And so we may think we know what a Democrat is here or a Republican is here, but that may not be the same thing in California or Alabama. And that creates some challenge for us as a people if we're going to use the party labels as a proxy for doing research on voters. In spite of all of those problems, the parties have a tendency to be responsive to voters because they want to win elections, obviously. And so their positions do change over time. And for us, those two major political parties still present fairly clear differences on a number of issues, enough issues that they're good proxies. I think a lot of people would like to have other options. We know that. And where they find those options, we have to wait and see. There's a process called de-alignment and realignment that takes place over time where the political parties lose voters. They de-align with the political parties, the voters do, because the party doesn't represent them. And then they may realign with a different party, or for that matter, a political party may completely change its stance. We've seen that happen over time. Layered on top of that, even though, is the way we draw our district boundaries here. We know that most of the districts that exist in both the state and federal legislative bodies are, quote, safe seats, which means the people running for them can run further out to the left or the right, depending on which sort of safe district it is. That tends to make the legislative bodies then also more polarized. And while that, on the one hand, makes it easier for us as voters to know which party we may want to support because they are differentiating themselves more, it might make it more difficult for us to find those candidates we like because while we may like one part of that highly partisan position on issues or that highly partisan stance, we don't like all of it. And that can then create a problem for us as voters.
Curtis Hill is unpopular. And Rokita is a known entity, but it's Todd Rokita, and he's been around in a variety of positions and very much a typical Indiana Republican politician, I think would be safe maybe. And I think the Democrats thought that might've been one they could have picked off. What happened?
Democrats absolutely thought they could pick that one off. They thought they'd be successful whether Curtis Hill received the nomination at the Republican convention or somebody else, because if it was Hill, they were simply going to go on the offensive against him. If it was anyone else, then they were going to try and tie that person to the behavior, to Hill's behavior, in the hopes that would be good enough. I think certainly one issue here is that it was very difficult for Weinsapel and others to make that solid connection between Todd Rokita and Curtis Hill's behavior. Todd Rokita was very good about saying, here's what I like about the positions that Curtis Hill has taken. So in other words, I'm a good conservative, vote for me. But his behavior was a little objectionable. And that was enough for a lot of voters, especially in a year when things are going pretty well for Republicans. So it was a challenge, to say the least. Now, Weinsapel started with a really nice financial position, and things were looking very good for a competitive race here. But there is absolutely no doubt that as the summer went on into the fall, more and more organizations understood the potential for Weinsapel to win, but also for Rokita to hold on to the race. And so there was a lot of money that came in late from groups like the Republican Attorney General's Association and others that gave Rokita enough money to then go toe-to-toe in terms of advertising with Weinsapel.
What about the governor's race?
The governor's race was always going to be challenging once we made it into the pandemic. And I know that that sounds like an odd thing to say, but leading up to that, when, you know, in the early part of the year, the Democrats had not really galvanized around a particular candidate yet. And then when they started to, we started to hear some talk about, you know, things, bad things happening in the world, so to speak, at a time when the likely Democratic nominee would have liked to be out raising a lot of money in, say, February, March, and April. That time got cut severely, and the ability to do that got cut severely by the pandemic. It was difficult to raise money because people weren't sure what was going to happen economically. It was difficult to do rallies and bring people together for fundraising events because we weren't supposed to be gathering together. And that really put Woody Myers behind the eight ball. On top of that, Eric Holcomb then took what most people consider to be a pretty middle-of-the-road approach to dealing with the pandemic. Now, there are people, obviously, who say he didn't do enough, and other people who said he did too much. I think that's kind of the definition of middle-of-the-road. But his approach made an awful lot of moderate Democrats say, you know what, he's doing all right. This is a very difficult time. Let's not change horses in midstream or whatever that expression is. Let's stick with the one who brought us, whichever one you want to use. And so they thought it's safe to stay with him. Woody Myers, during all of that time, as a former state health commissioner, could have been really on the offensive, but lacked the resources to do that, number one, in any sort of concerted way. And number two, a little hard to go at somebody who's taking a middle-of-the-road approach, because it means you have to be further out to the side. And being further out to the left is not a winning recipe in the state of Indiana in general that we know of, and certainly did not appear to be this year. So that meant take that problem, those problems he was having in terms of doing rallies and raising money, add on top of that the fact that the governor appeared to be doing what people considered to be, if not a good job, a good enough job at a time when maybe we don't want to change the leader. And that was just a bad recipe for Woody Myers.
Let's shrink down a little bit closer. Let's talk a little bit about state representative races in Northeast Indiana and state Senate races, just if there's any surprises there. Let's move more towards Northeast Indiana.
When it comes right down to it, Northeast Indiana was not a particularly exciting place as far as state House and state Senate seats are concerned. There was some belief that District 81 in the House was going to be quite exciting. This was Martin Carbaugh, the incumbent Republican, against Kyle Miller, a Democrat. This was a rematch from 2 years ago. 2 years ago, Miller got into the race late, closed what people consider to be a fairly substantial gap. When you take that, along with the fact that the district is, although Republican, not, you know, completely far right, safe district Republican kind of thing, there was a belief that if Kyle Miller got into the race in the beginning and ran a hard campaign with good support, he'd be able to maybe win that race. And so we saw somebody who campaigned very hard in terms of going door to door in Kyle Miller. We saw somebody who raised a lot of money. We saw somebody who was on television with some good looking commercials. And then, of course, what we saw was a response from Martin Carbaugh to be going out door to door and raising lots of money and having good looking television commercials. It ended up being a race that was watched from around the state. But in the end, 52-48 in terms of percentage victory for Martin Carbaugh. But let's remember, a year that was a very good year for Republicans. So maybe this is a race that could be won at the right time by the right Democrat. But, you know, everyone's going to remember Kyle Miller was an awfully good candidate with a pretty well-run campaign. A lot of people would say hard to imagine what else he could have done. it might be hard to convince people that that's a race that's worth putting major investment into again, say in 2 years or 4 years, unless there's definitely a blue wave coming at that time.
County office races around, really around Northeast A&M, very few of them were contested or heavily contested. There were some contested races for school boards. I think Fort Wayne Community Schools saw an incumbent losing a seat. There were some other races around Allen County in the school boards. For our listeners who might have tuned in on election night, we were unable to talk about a lot of these things because there was a technical difficulty at the Allen County Election Board that prevented the results from being available to us when you and I were talking in the studio. So let's kind of take advantage of this opportunity now to maybe touch on some of those things that we saw and then we didn't see when everything went away for a couple hours.
Education is a top issue in the state of Indiana, no matter what level of government you're looking at. Even folks who don't have a direct role to play in education will often talk about education because they know people pay attention to it. And one of the things we see because of that are some relatively hotly contested school board races. The four school corporations in Allen County saw contested races. In fact, uncontested races were the exception, not the rule. And we did see some very interesting things in terms of expected winners not doing as well as expected. We saw, as you pointed out, an incumbent actually turned out in a race, by the way, with three people running for it, and in a race that had, this is not one of those instances where there were two really good candidates and a third name just on the ballot. No, the lowest vote total was 26%, 27%. So that was a hotly, hotly contested race right there. And that's exciting because it means that people had an opportunity to talk about this issue that we all understand is so important, and that being education. So that was interesting, of course. I think the thing that may go down as the most interesting, though, comes out of the third district in Fort Wayne Community Schools, and that is that Tom Smith, who was on the ballot, he's currently on the school board, he was on the ballot shortly before the election, he said, never mind, I wish I had not filed, I've decided I don't want to run again. Please vote for my opponent, William Kreitel, who was on the ballot. I mean, Smith said, please, everybody go vote for him. And then Tom Smith won the election. So now the Fort Wayne Community School Board, for the third time in a fairly short period of time, will actually be going through a selection process. We're all familiar with when the parties get together and caucus somebody in. School boards are not done that way. They are nonpartisan races. The Fort Wayne Community School Board has already invited applicants. And what will happen is the school board will review the applicants, they'll conduct interviews with them, and then they will select somebody who will finish out this term, which is basically going to be an entire term, and then that person will run as an incumbent, and it will mean the third person serving on the board currently who was chosen through this process.
Is that an example of name familiarity? Voters go into the booth and they're like, oh, Tom Smith. I voted for him before. I voted for him lots of times before.
You know, Tom Smith has multiple advantages. Everybody knows a Tom Smith, and you might even know this Tom Smith. But he's a former member of Fort Wayne City Council. He won actually a very exciting election when he first got elected to City Council. He was known very much as a council member who was out in the community, going to all the neighborhood associations, doing those sorts of things. And he's done that still as a school board member. While there were signs out for Kreitel, they didn't go up very early, and they were relatively plain signs, in some respects effective because they were plain, but it's almost like he needed to take his race a bit more seriously than he did. Now, he has said he's going to submit his name to the board. Obviously, having Tom Smith's endorsement before the election is probably going to serve him well in that selection process. But in the end, Tom Smith, great name recognition.
In addition to the episode topics that come up in the WBOI Politics podcast, we try to also spend some time on current events. In past episodes, that meant addressing the October surprise of President Trump being diagnosed with COVID-19. For this episode, we're focusing locally on a recent story from WBOI reporter Zach Bernard, the push by Fort Wayne City Council Democrats to reinstate collective bargaining protections for certain union groups in the city. It was shot down by Republican colleagues without any discussion. Rebecca asked Andy about that in their conversation via Zoom.
the fact that the Republican members of the city council did not even bring it up for discussion, which seems to be largely unprecedented in how Fort Wayne City Council has done its business in the past, are we seeing a trickle down of intransigency that we see in some of our more august federal bodies, where bills or ordinances or policies brought forward by the non-majority party are viewed as unworthy of discussion? And if that's the case, should residents of Fort Wayne be concerned about that?
It is certainly unusual for the city council not to introduce a bill. And let's keep in mind, the vast majority of bills are passed with, you know, super majorities, if not unanimously. So this is not a body that is completely dysfunctional, as some might describe Congress. So we all need to keep that in mind. There is an argument by some that is, if we know a bill is not going to pass, then why should it be introduced? It will simply occupy time when other things could be discussed. And we need to keep in mind that legislative bodies have more things to address than they have time to address them. And that's a pretty reasonable argument for a lot of people. They'll say, yeah, if you know it's not going to pass, why introduce it? The problem is, part of the purpose of a legislative body is to actually deliberate and to have an informed discussion where people in the community are able to hear what is going on. There may be great benefit to not introducing a bill that is going to fail in terms of saving time for council. That does not mean that council should not be discussing the issues that would fail. And we do have a tradition of fifth Tuesdays for the city council of holding some meetings to discuss things. Perhaps the Republicans should have gone to the Democrats and said, you know, this is going to lose. Let's make it a fifth Tuesday discussion topic first, and then see what happens after that. That might not have gone over well with the Democrats, but it would have at least provided the community with the opportunity for the discussion to be had without the pressure of the no vote versus the yes vote on the bill.
From there, the next focus of the conversation was how the 2020 election impacted judges at states, appellate, supreme, or local levels. Were there any surprises?
No. I have looked back in our history, and when a judge goes up for retention, I have yet to find an example where a judge was not retained. That doesn't mean there wasn't one. It just means that my research wasn't as thorough as it should have been. We saw, for example, in Allen County, retention rates were 80% or better for the judges on the ballot, and that's probably what the state final results will be. It is really unusual for judges to fail to be retained. But we have to remember that's only one way judges keep their seat. We also have outright elections for them, some of them partisan, some of them nonpartisan, because we want to make it as confusing as possible, apparently, for voters in this area. We did see, in terms of the potentially contested races, a grand total of zero of them in Allen County were actually contested. And that, of course, means a lot of people won with 100%. And I'm good enough at predicting elections that when only one person is on the ballot, I'm relatively certain that one person is going to win. So no surprises there.